Hello and welcome back to Hacker Slacker. I'm Jacob Petticord.
And I'm Andre Garive.
And this week, we got a new iOS beta.
We do. We have three new iOS betas.
Finally got one of our intern interviews.
Yes, we finally got it. We had a really fun interview that will be at the end of this podcast here. And I think you'll really enjoy it.
Yep. And then we got some news on our elusive Bitcoin story, the Bitcoin heist story that we'll get here quick. So
that's the best story on Hacker Slacker.
Yeah, let's talk about our iOS betas.
Yes. Okay, so I downloaded iOS 13 beta 2 on my phone, iPadOS beta 2 on my iPad, and macOS Catalina beta 2 on my MacBook. My MacBook is behaving now, which I really appreciate. last week we had that technical issue. I was not a fan. Thankfully, everything is working now and a lot smoother. Stuff doesn't take 2 hours to save, which is really cool. On the iPad, not that much has changed, in all honesty. Jacob just downloaded the iPad.
Yeah, so I have the beta 2 on my iPad, which was also released as the first public beta, which is what I was waiting for. I saw a lot of stuff online about how, you know, the last couple of years, the public betas have been very stable, and people are like, oh, people are going to be pissed. Like, this public beta is not very stable. It's clearly not something that I would want on my main phone, Andre. because, like, I don't know, just, like, taking notes for the show, the notes app randomly quits.
Yeah, we were in the middle of the interview, and my notes app just closed several times.
Yeah, so that's happened to me a few times already, and I haven't even used my iPad that much. But I've been really excited to, you know, see the potential of everything that's coming to the iPad. You know, we've talked about it all the time, but the things that stand out to me are definitely, like, the slide over multitasking thing.
Yes.
Where you can have your own little app switcher for the app that slides over. I found that to be really cool, and then having two notes side by side, I've already had use cases for that. So all in all, this is, you know, stoked my excitement, but I don't really use my iPad, you know, full time in the summer
because,
you know,
I'm
use my
that.
Work computer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the fall will be really when I get to dig in and see how great this stuff really is.
Yeah, I actually noticed today at work, I finally started doing some stuff. I haven't really done that much at work this week, but I did notice one thing today. I was trying to use my work laptop and the Pixelbook pen,
mm-hmm.
which last summer I used, and I was pretty okay with it. I didn't really have any issues with it, but this year, after having used the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil, it felt like it was taking millennia to render what I was writing down. Like, the latency was so high compared to the Apple Pencil.
Yeah, you could tell the difference.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to have to take my iPad in just because I don't want to be using the Pixelbook pen for some stuff that I'm working on for a side project.
And as we were talking about this, your beta-driving laptop sounds like it's taking off like an airplane.
It does. It just got really hot. I mean, it's done this before, so, I mean, it's whatever. But iOS 13 as well, it's crashing less, which is really nice. Chrome doesn't work super well. Like, it closes out of all of your tabs if you leave the app.
Yeah, I'm wondering how long, you know, third-party apps probably won't be super nice until a lot closer to
September. I mean, first-party apps, native apps, really haven't been that great at this point.
Yeah.
But the Reminders app, I have absolutely loved. There's one really awesome user flow that I've been using a ton. I'll remember something I need to do when I get home from work. So I will just tap into the app. I hit scheduled. I click on today. And then you can just click a little navigation button, which then prompts you arriving at home or arriving at work. And since I have those places set up in my phone on my personal contact, I can just say, when I arrive home, remind me to do this. But it's much easier than it used to be. You used to have to, like, hit the info button and then arriving at a location. Now it's just you tap arriving home, and it will remind you when you get home to do some stuff. So I have a couple things here that I had set earlier today that it reminded me to do. And I really, really like that user flow. It makes using the app a lot easier. I really just feel that with the simplicity of setting that complicated of a notification, it has made it a much more usable app.
Well, and I think even people who maybe use Reminders to say, like, oh, remember, to buy the stuff at the grocery store, you know, like really casual users. When they get in the new Reminders app and all this stuff is exposed like so much more easily, they'll see stuff like that and actually be able to use some of these more powerful features. Whereas the old design made everything super complicated and, you know, difficult to work with. This new design will hopefully get people being, you know, more productive and being able to use more powerful features.
Yeah, another awesome thing that I did with it was I set a reminder that said, when I get to Target or when I'm near Target, remind me to buy aftershave because I just need more aftershave. And when I passed Target a couple times but not going to Target, I was, I think one time I was headed to your house and one time I was coming back from a work event. I passed the one Target here in Seattle. And it triggered the notification. And in previous iterations of the app, you could either like clear the notification and then it would just stay like as a reminder. It would have like the badge app or the app badge, and or you could mark it as completed. Now, if you clear it, it doesn't keep it as a app badge, but it will remind you again once you get back to Target.
That's awesome.
Which was super useful because it took me three times passing that Target to actually buy aftershave.
But yeah, it kept annoying you. There we go. Okay, we have to talk about it. The Quadriga news, for those of you who don't remember, this is our boy from Canada, the Canadian cryptocurrency exchange, the guy who fled to India, or who was on vacation in India and died and took a bunch of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of cryptocurrency with him in his offline wallets. The Canadian government had a investigation issued, and we got their kind of mid-investigation report. It's not like the final report, but they published this 70-page document last week that had kind of their findings on the operation of the exchange. People haven't really been successful in tracking down the money. The company owes around like $250 million to their users, and they only have around 24. And so the rest of it is somewhere in this guy's accounts. But basically, what came out of this report was like kind of crazy details about the operations of the exchange itself. So to start, they hadn't really kept any traditional accounting since 2015, which is impressive, you know, for a company operating at that scale. We've mentioned before that it seems like there's not that many people involved in the operating of this business. It's really just him. So there were no like checks and balances on him. The guy who ran the company, Gerald Cotton, he transferred millions of dollars into personal accounts on different exchanges. So basically, he could take the Bitcoin and move it to accounts. Like, so customers' Bitcoin that was supposed to be on his exchange, he was then trading with it on other exchanges. And one of the ideas behind this is that the company was already having financial issues, which was a major driver behind all of this. And some people were saying, and it is looking like by his, you know, activity on these other exchanges, that he was trying to trade his way out of the deficit. So essentially, like, his company was losing money because of operational costs, and he was taking his customers' money and placing bets with it, like doing a leverage speculation. And he bet on everything from, like, you know, some variants of Bitcoin to even like Dogecoin and stuff. And lost a ton of his customers' money even further.
Oh, no.
Which further complicated the financial situation. So, yeah, the plot thickens.
So I think what this means is once this is all wrapped up, Hacker Slacker will temporarily become a true crime podcast, and we will go through the entire saga of this, because this is the most interesting story we have told on this podcast, and I stand by this. I've stood by this since the first time we talked about this.
And it keeps coming up.
And we got all conspiracy to take Bill Simmons' bit, Conspiracy Andre and Conspiracy Jacob put on their conspiracy hats, and I have loved every bit of this. This man broke his company, essentially, that had no checks and balances. He lost everybody's money, and then he just went to India and pretended to die. It's amazing.
I'm surprised Reddit hasn't found him yet. I mean,
honestly,
I'm operating, you know, under the assumption that he is still alive.
Oh, he's definitely still alive.
You know, these government organizations, they're focused on the numbers and where everything went because they're trying to recover people's money. But yeah, you know, I want the personal story behind all this.
Honestly, when we started and I said he's definitely still alive when the first time we mentioned this last year, that was just wild speculation and me hoping this would become a conspiracy theory, and now it is, and I'm so happy.
Yeah, we might have to dig into some other people's conspiracy theories about this and see what people are saying sometime.
For sure.
Okay, now we're going to head into the news. The first bit of item that I will read after I reopen my notes app because it just crashed. Thanks, Beta. Is that the Raspberry Pi 4 was announced and put on sale. And I just kind of thought this was a good opportunity to talk about the Raspberry Pi. I've mentioned that I use it in combination with my iPad, which is kind of a unique use case. So one of the things about the iPad is that you can't really do a lot of developing on it. Like, it can't run a lot of the software creation technologies, you know, that we need to do our jobs. But a small machine like this, a Raspberry Pi, is what I used hooked up to my parents' network back in Kansas City to basically, you know, run my code on that instead and just use the iPad as an interface for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crazy thing about the Raspberry Pi is always its price point and size. So it's the size of like a deck of cards. It's just a little board with all the stuff on it. There's no like case or anything. So it's really simplistic and it all comes in for around $35. And so this new version of it, the Raspberry Pi 4, you know, there are speed bumps on everything, faster CPU, 4 gigs of RAM. Basically you can imagine this as like a budget phone, board with a decent amount of RAM and a bunch of like USB ports.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of use cases, especially as a programmer, for it. You know, you could run a small self-hosted website off of it. You could use it, as like a testing environment. And now for iPads, you could use it to run Visual Studio Code on the cloud. And then, have the Raspberry Pi serve that, you know, over the web to your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And have all the code running on the Raspberry Pi instead of the iPad. So it's kind of a unique little tool, and it's also used a lot in education because it's so cheap. It's like $35.
Yeah. There's a similar thing called an Arduino.
Yep.
We used Arduino kits in my high school physics class, but it's a very similar language. Like, it's basically a flavor of C that they used. And I didn't have a clue how to do that in high school, but they had some like pre-run programs and you just kind of had to hook stuff up. One of the really interesting things about the Raspberry Pi, however, is it has a really good set of I/O input-output ports, and that allows it to be very extendable for such a small computer.
Yeah, they even have these little like GPIO pins, which you can use to hook up to random like sensors and like kind of like specialized hardware. So I might have mentioned this before, but like one of my first programming projects was hooking up a Raspberry Pi to like a door sensor.
Oh.
So one piece of the sensor was on the frame of the door and one was on the actual door, and it made like a magnetic connection, and whenever the door was open, that connection broke, and the Raspberry Pi would detect that and then send it to Google Analytics, and so it could measure like real life foot traffic was the idea.
That's really interesting. Yeah, one project I've been wanting to do with my younger brothers, because they're at a very impressionable age, and I think getting them into technology now would be a great idea, is get like a broken laptop screen, hook it up to a Raspberry Pi, make like a custom box, and make a laptop that can run Minecraft. There's a version of Windows that they made that runs on the Raspberry Pi. So you just set that up. It has all the I/O. You can essentially create a laptop. You have to add in a keyboard and a mouse, and a trackpad's a little harder to do, but if you just add a keyboard and a mouse, you can run Minecraft. It's not that difficult of a program for any computer to run on this little Raspberry Pi, and you can have your own mini computer.
Yeah, they're fun little hardware projects, and one of the things that they did with this version was switch out one HDMI port for two micro HDMI ports. And the advantage of that is like you can hook it up to two 4K monitors at a time, which is crazy for like such a cheap device. You could essentially, you know, use it with monitors that themselves cost 10 times as much as the device itself.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of pushing it into more like, hey, you know, did you ever think about replacing your old noisy computer with this, you know, silent little board if you're just someone who browses the web or does programming stuff? But yeah, it's a neat little device. There's a lot to like about it. And if you're into that kind of thing, I would definitely recommend looking into it further. There's a lot of cool things people do with it. So yeah.
Yep.
The next story is possibly one of the biggest Apple stories that we'll have this year, and it's not hardware related.
It's not software related.
It's people related.
Yeah.
The man, the myth, the legend, Johnny Ive is quitting Apple.
He is leaving. He's creating his own design firm, of which Apple is one of his first customers already. But Johnny Ive is leaving. He's gone. It's kind of crazy because when you think about the iconic Apple designs that have come from the past 2.5 decades, he's the main factor in it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people who are more into the, you know, people who run Apple than I am, but just from, you know, Johnny Ive is someone that you hear about just if you're into Apple at all, really. He's been around since, you know, the early Steve Jobs coming back to Apple from Next Days. You know, he was part of the original Macintosh design, iPhone design. His thing is kind of Apple's industrial design, which has, you know, received numerous accolades. It's like the most well-renowned kind of design system that any company has had in a long time. Because when you think Apple, you know, you think premium design, and that's what Johnny Ive has been creating with his team, you know, for the last few decades.
Yeah, so if you ever see the Apple commercials where they introduce a device and it's all in a white room and it's one guy with a British accent.
He's the guy with the British
accent. That's Johnny Ive. It's really a lot of what we've seen, a lot of Steve Jobs' visions, a lot of Tim Cook's visions have been realized through his work.
Yeah, and so him leaving, he, in his, like, in the press statement about him leaving, he, you know, talked about his confidence in the people that he's leaving to run the design part of Apple, and him talking about running his own contracting firm, but that firm also, you know, working with Apple.
Yeah.
That's something that I feel like happens, you know, a big executive leaves, they want to go do their own thing. They talk about how they'll be around for a little bit. But I really do think we'll see a transition away from Johnny Ive. Like, he's not going to be designing every iPhone still. He left Apple for a reason. You know, he's probably tired of working on the same products. And his last major product was designing Apple Park, their new campus, you know, the crazy spaceship.
Yeah.
And so it feels like he's probably designed, you know, all the big major projects that are left. So I think it'll be something to watch for when we see new hardware products come out. If we can see, you know, a division between the old and the new design, because in recent years, his designs have come under a lot of criticism, especially when it relates to, like, the butterfly keyboard, the way that they're trading everything for slimness and look, and the way that they're being super minimalist and removing ports and that sort of thing.
There's a tweet here that says, Johnny Ive will still work for Apple, but will still require a special adapter.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what it is. Johnny Ive is now, he requires a dongle.
Yeah, but his unique touch on design will most likely be missed by Apple. And I am interested to see, however, how they proceed, what kind of new designs we see, because obviously it will still be the iconic Apple style design, but there will still be changes that happen, right? It's a new design team. It's a new person in charge. We're going to see changes. Not sure where we're going to see them first, not sure how big those changes will be, but we will definitely see these changes.
It's definitely a big question. Like, when it comes to singular voices, you know, driving Apple, it was Steve Jobs, obviously, and now it's Johnny Ive, and he's leaving, so
now it's Tim Cook.
Yeah, it's hard to judge how much of a day-to-day, you know, and big picture impact these guys really have from the outside, but if the talk is to be believed, Johnny Ive is, you know, one of the last remaining singular visions within Apple.
Yeah.
And so it'll be weird to, you know, watch the transition of maybe more design by committee type stuff.
Yeah.
See if they lose that strong voice or, you know, if they are able to transition to someone else taking that role.
Yeah. It'll be very fun to see what happens, however.
Okay. And more Apple news. Apple acquired AI self-driving car company, Drive AI. And people are speculating that this is essentially like a acqui-hire because they're taking on board a few dozen engineers. Drive AI hadn't been extremely successful. They'd raised a lot of money, I think around like $70 million in VC, but they've been looking for someone to acquire them over the last couple of years because they were going bankrupt. and so it's speculated that Apple bought them for less than the money that they raised in total. And the reason that this is interesting, you know, there's nothing that particularly excites me about Drive AI, but the word on the street was that Apple had given up on their self-driving car project and that they had moved people off of the team that was like actually creating a car because they had that going on for a while. I think that was like Project Titan or something like that. That was back in the early days of this podcast. Everyone thought that they were actually working on a new car.
Yeah, the early days of 10 months ago.
Yeah, and so now it shows that they're still thinking like about self-driving cars. And if that doesn't mean that they're making their own car, maybe it means that they'll be selling systems to car manufacturers. But that doesn't really seem very Apple-y. You know, they really just make consumer products. So are we going to see a consumer product that will allow you to make your car self-driving?
I'm interested to see, maybe it's just a way for them to integrate the way that they create their software with self-driving vehicles. Maybe they want to find a way for Siri to be usable within a self-driving ecosystem, because that is where we are headed. We are going to have vehicles that are self-driving and that are available for consumers within the next 15 years. That's just the state of technology and where it's headed. I don't know how many. I don't know how expensive they're going to be. I don't know how many companies will have them, but we will have these cars. And Apple, I think, wants to get ahead of it, because if you look with CarPlay, they were behind everything, right? And I think that if they are investing in your vehicle experience, they want your Apple ecosystem experience to be completely holistic with your life and also integrate into your vehicle.
Yeah, so maybe they're doing, you know, expanding CarPlay even further. There are these car manufacturers that also have to make the software that runs in the cars.
Yeah.
But, you know, as it transitions to self-driving cars, is Chevy really going to want to have their own self-driving division? Probably not. So maybe they're betting on making some sort of a car OS type thing.
Yeah.
Where they can handle all of the software for car manufacturers, and the car manufacturers can focus on making the cars.
Yeah. They can put the cameras and the hardware in it, but they don't have to worry about the software at all.
Yep. And then Apple can say, you just take our software, you know, we'll give the users a great experience, we'll update it, we will use our technology to enable the self-driving portion of it, you know, and you just pay us X amount of money per car.
Yeah. And then you can just say, hey, Apple Assistant, take me to this place, and then your car does that.
And from a user perspective, you know, nobody loves all of the built-in car software. I think everybody would take some Apple software over that.
Oh, so, for sure.
I mean, you already have CarPlay.
I'm loving the new CarPlay.
Yeah, so hopefully this is the direction that it's going, because I really don't think they're making their own car. I think that would be ridiculous.
No, I think so too.
And so I think that it could be a sign that there's a trend coming. You know, we've talked about the way Tesla is running their car's operating system is a lot more Apple-y, a lot more, you know, mobile OS related, where they have over-the-air updates to all of their systems.
Yeah.
They're constantly adding new features. And I could see traditional car manufacturers not wanting to build up the software teams.
For sure.
Or not really being specialized in that area to compete with that.
I don't really trust the Chrysler OTAs, to be completely honest.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it'll be a fun experience to see what happens with software and vehicles.
Yeah, there'll definitely be a major change. It's just going to be a matter of who's it going to come from. You know, are we going to see these car companies hire a lot more tech people? Or are we going to see tech companies get more into cars?
Yeah. All right. So two topics I don't think we talk about enough on this podcast are Apple and Seattle. What about you?
Yes. Yeah, so the last story we have here is also an Apple story. It's pointed out that Apple is going to be employing 2,000 people in Seattle over the next 5 years, I think it was, which is double what they previously announced. So they're kind of upping their future Seattle presence, which I love to hear as someone who's really enjoyed living here. And they are going to have 200 people here by the end of the year. Hearing that they have 2,000 people or will add 2,000 people is kind of crazy because, you know, I've seen the size of other companies' presence here.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, you can relate. Google's headed out of California. 2,000 seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot. Google also has, so we have a Redmond office, a Kirkland office, a Bellevue office. We have a Bothell office, which is north of Seattle, about 20 miles, I'd say, but that's not engineers. And then we have the office I'm in, which is the Seattle Fremont one, and they are building the new South Lake Union office. So it's a lot of distributed offices across the city of Seattle and the suburbs. So there are quite a few engineers. What's really interesting is that this kind of cements Seattle as the third tech city, right? Every big tech company has a significant presence in the Bay Area and in New York. And this really helps Seattle get set. Obviously, Microsoft and Amazon are headquartered out here. Google has offices. Facebook has offices out here. Those are four of the Facebook top five companies.
There's Amazon interns in your building.
Yes.
I mean, all of these tech companies are here. Apple was kind of the only missing piece.
Mm-hmm. And they're coming out here now. Not only that, but there's Boeing and Tesla offices out here. There's just so many tech offices. There are startups. There's companies like Zillow out here.
Uber and Lyft.
Lyft. We went to an event at the Lyft office. Yeah. It was really fun. And you really get to see that Seattle does have a thriving tech scene. And Apple is very much cementing their spot within that.
Yeah, but the big question, you know, that people here really ask about this type of thing is where are all those people going to live?
Yeah.
How is this all going to work? You know, we touched on that a little bit last episode, mm-hmm. And maybe that's a good future topic is talking about, you know, tech's impact on these cities.
Yeah.
Because we keep talking about it. Everywhere I go, I see, you know, pushback against the housing crunches and tech specifically and their role in doing that, and we're part of the problem. You know, we're interns with our intern housing and living in places that, you know, could be cheaper if there weren't people like us here.
Yeah. So one thing that's very intriguing is whether or not they'll be focusing on downtown or focusing on being in suburbs like Kirkland, Bellevue, and Redmond, because Seattle is a very extendable city. There are a lot of suburbs and there's a lot of area around Seattle that's still accessible to the downtown. However, it is very lucrative to be in the downtown area. Unfortunately, you can't bring in 2,000 engineers into the downtown area. So I would think they're going to have to build out in a city like Bellevue or Kirkland or Redmond, which is still a big city and still has these same problems, but is not nearly as dense as the downtown area of Seattle. Or maybe they even build north or south of Seattle.
Yeah, it's crazy here where like the suburb cities have more skyscrapers than like a lot of actual cities in the Midwest.
Exactly. It's just a very strange occurrence to see being from the Midwest and having grown up there. But I also think that Apple being in Seattle will help for the technical side of it and for tech culture in Seattle, but it definitely has its ramifications and it could be dangerous for a lot of people and a lot of neighborhoods.
But yeah, I don't know. I'd probably work there.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a top five tech company. They're in the Bay, they're in New York, they're in Seattle. And that's what you can say about every top five tech company now.
Yep. I mean, it's exciting living out here, seeing all the growth and all of the, there's actually a lot more companies here than I expected there to be.
Yeah.
You know, when you research, you don't see that all of these major companies also have presence in cities like this.
Yep.
So it's definitely showed the advantage of, you know, just being in a big city, other companies will try to be here too.
Yeah.
So you get exposed to a lot more. But yeah, it's been an interesting summer. And we just talked to someone from one of those companies.
Yes, we have an awesome interview with Ananya Paul. She is a grad student at Cornell Tech and an intern at Uber. So we will take a quick break and we will show you that interview. All right, we are here with Ananya Paul. Ananya is another intern out here in Seattle. Ananya, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Ananya. I'm a grad student at Cornell Tech studying information science. I'm currently interning as a software engineer at Uber. Before this, I was in India working as a software engineer, and I have a bachelor's degree in computer science. Other than my career in tech, I'm also a dancer.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about your dancing career, how it started and where it's taken you?
Yeah. I started dancing when I was, I think, 3 years old. My mother was an Indian classical dancer, Bharatanatyam dancer. And other than dancing, I was learning painting and music, like vocals. And I think my mother essentially decided that dance should be my primary art form, which is why it continued to the point that I was a professional dancer with Dancers Guild in Calcutta, my native city in India. When I was in Dancers Guild, my dance form was an Indian contemporary dance called Navanritya. I would go to Dancers Guild like 5 days a week and do call shows and paid shows. And I think it continued for a year. And then I prioritized my formal education in science and I got into undergrad and I studied computer science and engineering. And after that, I was a software engineer for 2 years. And over those period, I danced on and off on my own, doing some stage shows here and there, but I was not associated with a company. I think my dance became more important, or I found a way to use my skills as a technical person and to give dance a new shape or use dance differently at Cornell, where I am currently working on a project to use gesture to activate augmented reality and show dance movements through an AR app.
That is really interesting. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that?
So what happened is so I go to school at Cornell Tech in NYC, and that's in Roosevelt Island. In Roosevelt Island, we have a park called the Four Freedoms Park, and there's a statue of Franklin Roosevelt there. It's a bust, actually. We were discussing about the contribution of women in history, but there's not enough of their presence, physical presence, or a way for people to know as much as they know about how men have contributed in the society. And we wanted to focus on the absence of Eleanor Roosevelt at Four Freedoms Park, despite her political participation during Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. Not many people are aware of it. We wanted to communicate this participation using augmented reality and the power of dance.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about what the goal of the research is and how the dance is used in the in combined with technology?
Yeah. So I think the goal is twofold. One of them is using gesture to activate augmented reality. You can identify objects with AR kit mm-hmm. now and AR core using machine learning models, but for gesture activation, there are some SDKs that you have to buy, and we want to use specific dance gestures to activate AR.
So the dance is kind of a test case for controlling AR with gestures.
Yes. Other than that, we wanted to see how we can use whatever tools we have to impact people on the social issues like women empowerment through dance. How can we bring Four Freedoms Park to life with history, dance, and women empowerment using technology such as augmented reality? We wanted to know how can we use historic buildings that have specific features to project AR, and how can we create a valuable experience for visitors, both physically and virtually, which prompts an exchange for the work.
Oh, so is it a guided tour of the space in AR?
Somewhat guided. I don't think we do not want a story from what we have decided by our, what we have came to our final decision for our first iteration.
Mm-hmm.
We did not come up with a story, but we did come up with a plan of gamification. So there would be a way for you to activate the AR through gestures, and then you can flip AR cards and get Eleanor Roosevelt quotes on women empowerment on that.
So you can kind of go around and collect all the historical points and stuff like that?
Yes, that's the whole idea. So we have 18 panels in Four Freedoms Park, and there is something called the room. There's a space which is empty. We are using all the panels. Like for each panel, there would be some kind of AR activation. And when it's activated, you can see quotes.
I think that's like one of the use cases people think about for AR a lot, right? Like exposing the history behind a place. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool that, that's stuff you're working on, because we haven't actually seen it like hit the mainstream, I feel like. You know, you don't really see people like touring campuses and like looking at buildings in AR and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So like having a unique take on it where, you know, it combines the gestures and the dance and everything. Mm-hmm. That's really neat research.
We looked into a lot of places like, what can we do about it, because we wanted to integrate like history and social issues and like cutting edge technology. We did a lot of research and it does not exist much.
Mm-hmm.
And AR is in its nascent stages, and we did not find any project that combines all of them.
Yeah, so I mean, that's obviously pushing, you know, farther a lot of cool areas. So, and then this summer you're also interning at Uber. So do you want to tell us a little bit about maybe like the team you're working on and the company and what you've thought so far?
Yes, like working at Uber as an intern is very exciting. Because it's a late stage startup, it has some structure, but I also feel like there's a lot of scope to quickly build something and test it out. I am currently working in an admin tool for scheduled and premium rides. Do you know that Uber has a feature to schedule rides?
I don't think they have it in Lincoln where we're from, because there's been times where I needed to schedule like a ride to an airport in the morning or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I'd use Lyft because Uber's wasn't available in Lincoln.
Yeah.
But
I've used it in other cities, but definitely not in our hometown.
Uh-huh. It's useful though.
Yes, it very much is.
Yeah, so it's not available in all the cities.
Mm-hmm.
It's available in some. I am working on that, like how to present this information better to operations and like where it's available, when it's available.
That makes a lot of sense. With the team you're on and within the atmosphere of Uber, have you found yourself being able to contribute your work in a way you find meaningful to your technological background as well as your arts background?
I would say technological background. I'm not sure about arts, but at the same time, I have other interests as well that like Uber is helping me explore. Like I got recruited as a software engineering intern, and so but like when I started and I was working on a tiny project, which is a software engineering project, I asked my manager that I wanted some product exposure, and he decided that I should get that. So I wrote the product review document of my project myself. So there were some initial ideas, but I spoke to the product manager in the team, the users, the operations people, the product ops people, and designers, and anyone who's a stakeholder. I did all the requirements gathering, and with the designer, I built the product to multiple iterations. And I think that's great. Like they recruited me for software engineering, but like having to get this exposure is really great. Yeah. So I can shape my internship the way I want here.
That's
which is cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of the things that I've kind of noticed is like a through line through from what we've seen from when you were at Dancers Guild to now at Cornell Tech and even here at Uber is the progression I've seen is that you can kind of mold these things into what you want them to be. Is that something that comes from being a dancer, do you think, that you just naturally hope to be able to live life in the way that you prefer?
That's an interesting question. I would say that's because of my personality. I'm an A-type person, so like...
Okay.
So I believe that I get to decide but what I want to do with my life. But the thing about arts is it gives you a space, a freedom to think and be whoever you want to be. So even when you are playing some character, some part of you believes that you are that character. When you play that over and over again in different characters, you start believing that this can come true. So you do not have to live a life that is like your parents are saying, or someone decides that someone who's born like this in the city has to do it like this. And you can just decide it. I think like that kind of helps me. And I've also seen a lot of people around me shaping their lives the way they want.
Yeah,
so I guess that's there. Yeah.
So you said earlier that you kind of decided to shift some of your focus from dance to academics, and that's what's led you to where you are now. What was that decision kind of like for you?
I was in two minds. I struggled a lot to decide if I wanted to study science or arts, and it's not very interdisciplinary back in India. It's either this or that. I think my choice was based on a lot of practical factors, because like the industry in art is such that you do not get enough returns on investment. You get like you hear like a lot of stories where people have put all their energy, people know the right people, they have done everything they could, but they could not be successful. But with science, you can always do something, you can always feed yourself. And that was the primary reason that I decided to go ahead with science. But this is something, like art is something that can never go away. Like it'll always stay with you, which is why when I came to Cornell Tech, I saw that people from arts background, like the person who is mentoring us for our specialization project, AR project, he has been a performer. Even the person who is mentoring us for our project, he comes from Royal Opera House. He has been a performer with Shakespeare's Globe. And he did his PhD in performance studies, like aging and embodied technology. That's like so far different from what we are doing. And I think that makes our project so interesting. Like, we have help from people who have specialized in the tech, like in AR or in design. But like having him on board, it just like gives a different perspective to it. And it's just amazing. Like a person like him, he's a DLI fellow, which is like he's a research fellow at Cornell Tech. Like a person who comes from an artistic background is helping people in tech to do tech work. That's just amazing. And I feel like home, is that the right word to say? Because it's like people in art and tech doing things together.
Yeah, it makes sense. Rather than a crossroads where they intersect, it's more of a multi-lane highway where they're going the same direction together.
Do you feel like there was anything you did to put yourself in that position where you could combine your passion and, you know, the practical need for like a engineering career? Or do you think you just kind of got lucky in a way?
I never thought they were different in the first place. I think that's just something people say, but I originally, when I was a dancer, I was learning classical dance. I could show, like, in my classroom, I would show that I solved this beats by LCM. Like, the dance instructor would ask, like, how many beats do you need to complete this in, like, theory class of dance? And I was like, I answered this by LCM. That was when I was a kid. And like in classical dance form, you use a lot of math, way more.
Really? I didn't know that. So like what are some like cases in classical dance where you're using math?
It's a lot of beats and you experiment with different music. So there are beats that fall on the music. There are beats that fall off the music. So there's like 2 second gap after which you put your foot down or you do a mudra. And there is synchronization and different combinations of those. And I think like even if they go differently and they are off, like after every beat, they come together.
So it's a little bit of like systems equation type stuff where you're some math, you know, with your dance.
It's not that complicated, I would say, but like you can do that.
Yeah.
Like
it's almost as if you are you're performing your dances with a mathematical mindset, but you're also creating your products with an artistic mindset.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. And even in terms of science, I think like art gives you an open mind to like not, you can think out of box, because with art you can just like bend anything and everything.
Yeah. So if you had to talk to yourself as a little girl back in India, mm-hmm. What would you say as like the biggest piece of advice mm-hmm. for going forward in life?
That you're doing fine. That the fact that you love all the things that you love, it's fine. You do not have to choose something over the other. You can love solving complex mathematical problems. You can love being a dancer. You can do whatever you want to do. It's fine. Like, you're doing fine. Like, don't doubt yourself.
That's some great advice. Yeah. All right. Awesome. So do you have any sort of online presence that you want people to know about?
Yeah, I do have a website.
All right, cool. Yeah. She will give us her website. We will put that in the show notes. You should absolutely go check that out. Ananya, this has been awesome. It was a super fun interview, and it was really great to meet you. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me over.
All right, thanks for listening to Hacker Slacker. You can send us an email at hackerslackerpod@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Twitter @hackerspod, or you can send us an Anchor voice message. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Bye.